Sagar and Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
I am so intrigued consistently all the time, every day. I log onto the internet and I see a really great small community that you've never heard of before. And there is so much value in that. I think we've, for so many years, put a lot of stock in scale, to your point, like the mics, the BuzzFeeds of the world, that built up these really big, noticeable, recognizable brands, but didn't really have the talent or the content to back it up in a lot of cases. I think there's a reverse of that happening now. And perhaps it's a reaction to a lot of really sour headlines around media over the last decade or so. But now people recognize, I went viral on TikTok for this specific kind of content that I'm really, really good at, that I can do better than anybody else. How am I going to create a community of like-minded people who really like that kind of content? Whether it's, you know, like the now famous TikTok influencer Tinks, right? Like she's TikTok's big sister. That's her niche. And she has a really, really voracious audience who's eager to fall on her every word. You know, there are all sorts of influencers all over the internet today who are doing things just like that, creating newsletters around those personalities, creating podcasts around those personalities, and even people in the media space as well, more traditional media. When you talk about journalists leaving the New York Times to go write for Substack, and that's not a shock anymore, that's insane.
We've got some great guests for you guys today, Kinsey Grant and Josh Kaplan from Thinking is Cool. It's an awesome new podcast. We have a great conversation about all things podcasting, how to build a media company, all of that. It was really the perfect one in order to take me out because I am going on vacation next week. So I wanted to end it on a really fun one. And Marshall, that's certainly what we got.
Yeah, we get so many audience Q&As about how do I break into the podcasting industry? How should I think about a media company? What is this phenomenon in the mainstream or independent media? So we thought we would do a meta episode instead of going on break in August and talk about podcasting with other podcasters. There's a lot here. We definitely do a good job of bringing other content. There's a debate about billionaires. We debate Joe Rogan and Spotify and platforms and responsibility. So much good stuff here. I really like how we merged both like the political, policy, editorial content with just this idea that we're doing this thing of building companies here. So really exciting. Lots of great stuff. Because we're kind of going on a semi-chill vacation, we're not going to read you the whole riot act, different things to check out, but go look in the show notes or read the Substack to learn more. Let's get into this really awesome episode. And of course, thank our friends at the Lincoln Network for supporting the podcast. Kinsey Grant, Josh Kaplan, welcome to The Realignment.
Thank you so much for having us. Thrilled to be here.
Thank you.
Good to see you guys.
It's August. We were debating the type of episodes we want to put together this month, and I think we really wanted to just do something fun. We get a lot of questions from the audience about media companies, podcasting. So the two of you are also building your own media companies. So this is a really meta, but also newsy directed conversation we're looking to have. So I want to start here, Kinsey, and then I'd love to get your answer, Josh. My perception is anytime someone leaves an existing institution to start something new, they're implicitly or explicitly launching some type of critique of that institution. So for me, for example, I go to PBS, I realize we're creating a public affairs show for people who are 70 plus, and I say, hey, I should start a podcast instead because that's somewhat more relevant to our audience. Sagar goes from The Hill, does Breaking Points. What, from your perspective, coming from Morning Brew to Thinking is Cool, are you launching from a critique-wise of our industry?
That is a fantastic question to begin with, and definitely a hard-hitting one. I think that the decision to leave Morning Brew was not one made out of any major, you know, discomfort or disillusionment even with the company itself. I think that it is a product that is still worth making. News for young people, business news for young people is still a worthwhile pursuit. I still feel really strongly about the promise of email, and it was a great company. But that being said, the decision to leave was more about pursuing something that I felt drawn to personally. And for me, that was being honest and having a personality, being myself, and being open about owning my opinions and owning the product that I was creating with those opinions as well. I am still through and through a journalist. That will always be part of who I am. But with this new product, Thinking is Cool, that I've created, I have the ability to do my reporting, to go out and talk to people, to hear diverse perspectives, and then say, here's what I've learned, and here's how it's changed the way that I thought about this particular issue at hand. So I think that is really what I was searching for when I decided to leave a great company. And it was something that I found in making the show, which has been really gratifying.
What do you think, Josh?
I agree with all that. Thinking is Cool is a brand and a storyline that Kinsey and I very much love, about nuance, about picking topics that might be too taboo for certain entities, not being so capital B business forward. I think that's a little intimidating for some of the audience that Kinsey's really good at appealing to. And on the business side, where I'm focusing, it's a great time to be an independent creator. If you are the type of person that wants your face on it, your name on it, it's amazing. The tools are right there in front of us. The social media platforms are very welcoming right now and turning. I'm sure we'll talk more about that. But the cost of doing this has dropped dramatically. And so for Kinsey to get to own her company, her IP, and for us to get to monetize it in different ways, for her speaking somewhere, for her inventory on her podcast, for those ad sales, to sell merch, all things that we're doing right now, it's been incredible. And it's been fun, and it's been the two of us. We're now growing a team, but it's a very different business model, and it doesn't mean it's better. It's just a different business model that for Josh Kaplan and Kinsey Grant is particularly good right now and is really fun. And yeah, we also are very risky. We wanted to take a risk. We wanted to jump off and try something of our own. And this is it. Like, this is the embodiment of our brains coming together and saying, like, from a business and editorial perspective, let's have some fun.
Yeah, I also think that it's important. Josh has alluded a little bit to the idea that we're creating this community, this kind of ecosystem of people who are looking for something more. It doesn't mean that there can't be a community around more quick hit kind of a news product, but that's what Morning Brew was, right? It was, at most, you're going to get 300 words on a story. That was great for some stories, but it is my belief, and it's the belief of a lot of people in the community that we've built with Thinking is Cool too, that there are certain stories that need more than that. You need to hear more when you're talking about the future of porn or political parties or barstool sports. There are complicated stories that deserve complicated storytelling to go with it. And I think the job that I've kind of taken up is taking that complicated story and making it more understandable for people who are eager to learn more about what is going to be a pressing issue. Maybe they don't know it's one yet, but it's going to be.
So here's a fun question, since I also recently went through this. It turns out starting your own business is actually really hard. It turns out that, you know, people have seen, you know, the success of Breaking Points, and they all, you know, I have friends who work in, you know, major corporations, corporate journalism, whatever. And they're like, dude, like, maybe I should do it. And I'm like, yeah, maybe don't though. Like, are you ready? Like, are you actually ready? Because, you know, right before this, I had to come from an hour and a half long tax meeting. And because of a Supreme Court case, apparently there are all these taxes, you know, you have to like estimate stuff by population. It's a lot. It takes a lot. Like, there's a lot of stuff. And that's just like the least of your worries. So I'm curious, for people out there, they're definitely out there who are listening and they're like, I want to do it. I want to go independent. Josh, you're not wrong. It's cheaper to do. That doesn't mean it's easy. So let's go through, I think, for people who are listening, what are the things that made the less sexy parts of actually starting your own business, and what it means to actually be a creator who owns your IP? You don't have a lawyer. You don't have necessarily an accountant or anything. You're starting off from scratch. Josh, you can start, and Kinsey, I'd also love to hear what you have to say.
Oh, I wish Kinsey got to start this one. This would.
Push him. Just for that.
All right.
Look, this is, you say it's the unsexy stuff. You say it's the hard stuff. For me, as in the way that my brain works, I'm a project manager, really, by trade. I love making sure that these things happen. When Kinsey's got an amazing idea, I go, great, what day? When are we doing it? And so when you say that, I go, that's actually how I think. And so that's why we love working together, because when Kinsey puts together an incredible narrative, I go, I don't know how the hell you did that. I can talk shit. I can, right, you know, try and edit it. I can push her on certain things. I can call her out on why she thinks billionaires shouldn't exist. I can do whatever. But when it comes to a blank Google Doc and coming up with a podcast episode, that's over my head. I like all the stuff you just did for whatever reason. And I think, again, like there is a lot, and I like going to different people and asking questions, because it's all been done before. A lot of people are very willing to help us, and we're very appreciative of it. But when I look at it, every time there's a new SaaS product, there's a new software that does it for me, how to calculate your quarterly tax payment. I'm like, That seems easier than what it must have been 25 years ago. I tweeted something silly the other day that was like, I don't know how people did business before Google Drive. How you can't share it. I'm like, I just don't understand.
How did that work before the internet?
I don't know. I set up Gusto. Gusto.
Yeah, it's easy. Yeah.
We should get some ad money for that. But I don't know, but like something like Gusto for payroll.
I use Waves. Waves, go ahead and sponsor me. All right. Yeah.
But Gusto was easy. It took like a couple of days to register as an employer for something and to do something else. But it's relatively intuitive. And if you have a problem, you just ask the service person on the other side and they're pretty helpful. So, yeah, I mean, I could go through the steps. I'd love to. But as far as filing to create a business, making sure that we've got the right chart of accounts on QuickBooks, creating a business banking account, making sure you've got the right legal forms when you have somebody as a guest or when you do something for your privacy policy and your terms of service. I'm always finding out little things that we should be doing or learning about. And I write all this stuff down on notes and stuff like that. So I'm probably missing a bunch, but there's a lot that goes into it, but I like it. This is the fun part for me.
I think that Josh's passion when talking about payroll and accounting is the exact reason why we work together, because all of that stuff is the stuff I never want to do ever. Yeah. I don't know how. It's not my superpower. It's not what I'm interested in doing. But I think it kind of illustrates the idea that today there's this expectation that when you quote unquote go independent, you have to be 100% working by yourself. And that's not the case anymore. If you have somebody like a Josh in your life who's really good at doing these things and can be an intellectual sparring partner, but can also make sure that you pay your taxes, go find that person and see if they want to work together. You know, like there are ways around trying to, I don't know, work yourself into a lather figuring out your taxes, whether it's finding a freelancer, finding a friend who can help you, or just using all the tools that are available right now. Like, it's not something I'm good at. I'm never going to be good at it, but I'm okay with that. I can write and I can talk into a microphone.
Mm-hmm. We're here to promote co-founder Discord. So Josh, you referenced it. Let's get into the billionaires debate so we could hit a bit of the content you're having. So Kinsey, let's start with you. What is your perspective on billionaires, which also frankly is, it's interesting coming from the Morning Brew business background, and even before Morning Brew too, right? You're basically, a lot of your interviews are with billionaires. We've spoken to a lot of billionaires. So like, let's just get your take on billionaires and the broader debate. Then Josh, please come in and hopefully clash a bit. We love clash here.
Oh, we definitely clash on this one. This has been a fun one to report out. So it is my personal belief as Kinsey Grant, journalist and not billionaire, that it should not be possible for billionaires to accumulate the kind of wealth that they have in the United States at this point. I understand that there are arguments in favor of the existence of billionaires. And when I say the existence of billionaires, I mean the possibility of becoming a billionaire, not that, you know, Bill Gates should go to the fiery gates of hell, right? Like, this is what I mean. To me, those arguments are not as strong as the idea that wealth inequality in the United States is going to be the pressing problem of this generation. There are obviously several pressing problems of this generation, but I think that that is the foremost right now. And to me, the existence of somebody to accumulate, what, $170 billion in net worth is completely backwards. And that is allowed to happen because of legislative decisions, you know, in the tax code, right? Like, these decisions that are being made by people who aren't billionaires themselves, they are being made in favor of these people who can accumulate this kind of wealth. We do not have a wealth tax. We have an income tax. And it is painfully obvious that the mega wealthy in the United States have deployed tools that everyday people simply do not have access to grow their wealth in a way that we could never dream of. So it's my belief that they should not exist. But I know that I can see Josh trumping at the bit prove me wrong.
And the quick thing we need to add here, Kinsey, as you pointed out, Kinsey Grant, journalist, non-billionaire. I'm going to guess that Josh Kaplan, aspiring billionaire. So let's just hit that editorial and let's hear your perspective.
I'm okay with that. And we'll do a little roll call. Kinsey Grant, are you a capitalist?
Yes, I believe in some of the core tenets of capitalism.
Marshall?
Yeah.
Sagar?
100%.
All right, so we're all capitalists here. We all believe in the system. I think there's a lot of discourse around different systems right now. But I agree with you on a lot of the points that wealth inequality is going to be one of the defining problems of our generation. I don't agree on capping ambition. And I think like one of the best parts about what we've done. Oh, and she puts her head back
Come
and rolls her eyes.
Come on.
there are certain things that we very much agree on. This is not just like binary on the conversation around should they exist. I think that they should be allowed to exist, but the means of becoming one should be significantly harder. Mm-hmm. I was taught in school that we have a progressive tax system. We clearly do not, right? Like by whatever loopholes or laws or legislation, it is regressive, and the richer you get, the less you pay in taxes. And I don't like that. So there's certain things that I completely agree with you on. The ways that a lot of these people become billionaires then becomes outlawed a couple of years later. Like a lot of these rules are changing, but they're not changing fast enough. So I think we do need better legislation, better protections over wealth inequality, and ways to make sure that everybody has access to education and healthcare and infrastructure and everything. But to lead with the narrative that in America you have a certain ceiling on your wealth, I just can't get behind that from a talking point. I think on a lot of the logistics that you suggested in the episode, I'm fully with you. There is one that might lead to another interesting conversation about the wealth tax, that it's really, really hard from a logistics standpoint to tax wealth rather than income.
It actually could also be unconstitutional. I've actually heard that before.
There you go. So no, I just, there's a lot of interesting parts to it. Yeah, go for it.
No, I'm just, I've had this argument with Crystal many times, so I'll throw my stock answer here, which is that, and I'm curious for your perspective on this, Kinsey. I actually think looking at Bezos or Musk, the extreme outliers, is really the wrong way to do it. Because in a way, that's kind of what you want. You want, Jeff Bezos created the Everything Store. The Everything Store is one of the most brilliant. Look, I'm not a shill for Amazon. I have a lot of critiques of Amazon. They're anti-union busting. I think all that, I've talked about it ad nauseum. That being said, it's a really good idea. Elon Musk, SpaceX, cool. Tesla, cool. The problem I have is that I was looking at the Forbes list of 2020. The most common way to become a billionaire today is not to actually create an innovative company. It's to basically act as a leech on the financial system by payment for order flow, hedge funds, all sorts of just like financial inefficiencies, which private equity, as far as I can tell, these people are not adding any value to the American economy. I mean, I'm sure they would have plenty of counters in the Wall Street Journal editorial page, but I'm saying from what I think, I don't think that those types of billionaires should exist necessarily. Somebody like Ken Griffin. Whereas if you're creating like hard science product, or if you are creating like Amazon is a good idea. Creating Amazon, I think that's perfectly fine. So that's my addition to the discourse. I'm curious what you guys think.
I think it's a really, really well-made point, and one that I take well too. You know, I think part of the reason that we love to dunk on Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos in particular is because they're easy to. Like, it's easy to punch up and say, do you have any idea how vast the number $170 billion is? Most people simply do not. And so to use that as a point to illustrate just how different their life is from yours, I think is often a useful point in discourse, right? But I completely agree that the more problematic wealth accumulation in the United States today isn't those people. Sure, they have a ton of it, but that's not the vast amount of wealth. And it almost brings up this idea of, and I've heard this before, I think Josh has brought it up to me before as well. If you cap the amount of wealth that somebody can accumulate in a specific country, are you capping the amount of innovation that will flow into that country, or rather will come from that country, will flow out of that country? I don't think that you are if you give people the chance to understand where this money actually is, right? I'm not going to be any less inclined to create a life-changing drug, right? Or to, I don't know, create a viral podcast because I think it's going to make me a 99 millionaire instead of a billionaire. You know, like that to me is not going to deter me from innovating if that is what I'm drawn to do. Like, are you innovating because you want to become worth $3 billion? Are you innovating because there is a reason, there's a need in the market, and you have to meet that need specifically with your skill set?
So this is interesting though, because maybe the question at hand is, who are we talking about, right? So the individual inventor, the individual business person, maybe that's not what's motivating them. But if we're talking about like venture capital, what's definitely motivating a venture capitalist to actually invest in a serious hard tech product like SpaceX, like a Tesla? It's the idea that you're going to get a 10X, aka $1 billion plus return. If you are a hedge fund or a university that's trying to put your funds into something that funds those venture firms, you want to see that too. So I think it's important to focus on the individual actors. But I think the most important thing that we're all agreeing on here, and this is where I'm curious, we'll get into this later, like lessons we've learned from podcasting. Something I've learned is that we should really look at what people are actually saying. And I think what people are actually saying when they're talking about billionaires is something we all agree on, which is that there's a lot of unfairness in the system. And if being a billionaire is a stand-in for, like Sagar said, financialization, or the two of you said, for like using the legislative process to affect things in an unfair way, that's what people tend to really be talking about.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think that the interesting part of creating this specific episode of Thinking is Cool was hearing from so many people. You know, I thought that I might be in the minority. And granted, I have like a decently young millennial liberal audience, but I thought that I would be more in the minority in saying, I don't think that this should happen, or I don't think that we should have a system that encourages this to happen regularly. A lot of people agreed with me. Like a lot of people who I was not expecting to agreed with me. Unsurprisingly, though, a lot of people who disagreed with me were the kinds of people who bought in like hook, line, and sinker to the grind your way to the top, the American dream, like pick yourself up by your bootstraps, because that's what they've been sold. That's what's been forced down our throats from age like six, right? As soon as you can read, you hear about the American dream. And that's just not the reality for so many people. And it's just, it's been interesting to hear the perspectives of people who completely disagree with any sort of like wealth tax, any sort of wealth inequality conversation they're not interested in having. It's often because of this rhetoric that has been given to them, handed to them. And that's, you know, at the end of the day, whose fault is that? Perhaps it's the media. Like that's the bigger question. What's our responsibility in all of this?
Wow, Kinsey, thank you so much for your setup to pivot. I was wondering how am I possibly going to do this. I'm commenting on it so it doesn't
podcast
count.
But
that's important. So speaking of media, because I really want this episode to be a tool for folks who are thinking about this exciting space, because I like to think about media through the lens of different eras, right? So if this is the 1990s, we're thinking, hey, like, how do we get like the Oregonian, my state newspaper onto the internet? And what you're going to do is you're just going to take the paper copy and put it online in a not particularly useful way that doesn't actually save your business model, RIP state and local newspapers. But if this is then the post Facebook era, so if we were having this conversation in 2010 or 2014, we'd be talking about, hey, we're millennials, we're, you know, Gen Z adjacent, we're super good at using Facebook. So Josh, what's your tool for helping Kinsey go viral on Facebook? Teach me about that part. But that's not the conversation. We'd also probably be talking about us raising significant amounts of money, because to your point about the tools being there and being easier, we're not, and no offense if you two know these people, but we're not Mike.com, we're not BuzzFeed, we're just in a different era. It's much more personality based and building brands around personalities than building massive brands and trying to figure it out that way. So starting with you, Kinsey, I believe we're on you to go first here. Can you just define from your perspective, like what is the media narrative, quote unquote, in the year 2021, if you're ambitious and looking to build something?
I think the media narrative in 2021 for anyone ambitious and looking to build something is to create a community around what you're really good at. I am so intrigued consistently all the time, every day I log onto the internet and I see a really great small community that you've never heard of before. And there's so much value in that. I think we've for so many years put a lot of stock in scale, to your point, like the Mikes, the BuzzFeeds of the world that built up these really big, noticeable, recognizable brands, but didn't really have the talent or the content to back it up in a lot of cases. I think there's a reverse of that happening now. And perhaps it's a reaction to a lot of really sour headlines around media over the last decade or so. But now people recognize, I went viral on TikTok for this specific kind of content that I'm really, really good at, that I can do better than anybody else. How am I going to create a community of like-minded people who really like that kind of content? Whether it's, you know, like the now famous TikTok influencer Tinks, right? Like she's TikTok's big sister. That's her niche. And she has a really, really voracious audience who's eager to fall on her every word. You know, there are all sorts of influencers all over the internet today who are doing things just like that, creating newsletters around those personalities, creating podcasts around those personalities, and even people in the media space as well, more traditional media. When you talk about journalists leaving the New York Times to go write for Substack, and that's not a shock anymore, that's insane. If you think about reading that, like Charlie Wartzell was leaving the New York Times to go start a newsletter, I would have been absolutely dumbfounded 5 years ago. But when that happened earlier this year, I was like, yeah, makes sense to me, right? Like, because he has such an eager audience to follow him and his specific kind of content. So to me, it's these specific niches that people have created for themselves around a personal brand that are, you know, scalable to an extent. But I don't really think that that's the defining factor for media success anymore. It's not about how big your audience can get. It's about how deep you can get within that audience.
How about you, Josh?
Do I have more? No, I've got more. I've got a little bit more. It's from a different angle. I completely agree with Kinsey. A lot of what she said is the era of personalization, which I think is fantastic. You get to find what's really made for you that really makes you happy. I zoom out a little bit as well and look at what was legacy media. They were gatekeepers. They had access to the radio stations, to the TV stations, to the airwaves. And it was really hard it was next to impossible for anybody to get on and get distributed if you didn't have enough money to print your CD. I just used like four different mediums in one sentence.
Terrible media company you're describing.
but if you're legacy media, you've got distribution, and then you probably have editorial or talent on one side and advertising on the other. The main way of making money was advertising. And now all of those gatekeeping abilities are gone. We can make podcasts with very little capital. We can distribute it with very little capital. And that means that we should be on multiple platforms and we should have multiple revenue streams. So then you ask the question, like, what is a media company? We make money in a number of different ways. A lot of it is content driven, but we also sell hats. So are we now an apparel company? I don't really know. But the thing that I keep looking at is there's this new level of complexity around choosing which platforms. You probably don't want only one, because if something changes there, you're wiped out. And if you want multiple revenue streams, because you can get really good ads, and then you can also sell a product to your audience, or you can partner with a company here or there. So it's a little bit more complex, but each individual unit is much more simple. So that's how I see this like weird stage of media of just being much more distributed across revenue streams and products and platforms. How many jargon words I just use? But that's where I see a lot of it going, as a result of both the technology changing and what Kinsey was talking about as far as being able to be that much more specific and find your community and find your voice. And I'm very excited by that. I'd never imagined working in media or what we're calling creator economy, but this is really fun to navigate all of those different choices and see how we can make it happen.
Let me follow up with you there, Josh. I was really afraid before we launched Breaking Points. When was it? I guess 2 months ago. So June 1st. And I was like, man, there's all these Substacks out there already. Are people going to pay? You know, it was one of those things where I was like, wow, Glenn Greenwald's my friend. He's got a Substack. Matt Taibbi's my friend. He's got a Substack. I think pay for 7 between podcasts and Substacks. And so like for me to get, you know, at this point, now I'm going to be like, okay, well, am I getting it, you know, from there? I was blown away though by the response. And it was something where I actually thought about something that Ben Thompson once said, which is that people underestimate just how big the internet is. Like, the internet is huge. And yeah, you may know somebody who pays for, or you may pay 7. You may even know 10 people who all charge. But because the internet and the ability to expand your audience just so big across platforms, especially where we were on YouTube, we're talking about millions of people, then those, you know, those individuals, they don't necessarily pay for anything. They just only support you. It was a really good lesson in not having like a scarcity mindset. I am curious though, from your guys' perspective, which is that how do you put yourself in a position where you can have that ability to be like, oh, I can appeal to an audience which isn't being served right now. Like when you think about it from a business perspective, because I do see, and I'm not going to name any names, there are a lot of people out there who do go independent, and they're catering to the same audience of where there's already like 10 Substacks, or where legacy media actually does a really good job already of delivering. I'm like, why would I pay for you when I can, you know, subscribe to the New York Times? So I'm curious like how you guys thought about creating something unique that something will actually appeal to, and what that means for the business. Josh, you can start, or Kinsey. Whichever wants to take it.
I'll do my zoom out thing again, and then Kinsey will say something really smart.
Mine's a zoom in.
Okay, perfect. Love when that happens. We're very specific to podcasting on what Kinsey and I do. And I look at the radio numbers, radio advertising. Yeah, there's a lot of music and stuff tossed in there, but radio is still like 35 times as big as podcasting. Maybe that's like huge. A year or two old. But radio is massive. And also cable is still massive. We were talking earlier about the CNN Plus stuff, and like CNN as a cable company still makes like $1 billion profit or something like that. And so there's still so much money, probably generational money, that my parents, my grandparents, they're still listening to the radio, watching cable. So we're seeing this crazy shift to on-demand digital content. And I guess even live audio, which is the same thing as radio, but we won't talk about those things yet. But there's still so much stuff coming over into these like new media types. So agreed, the internet is massive and only getting bigger as each generation becomes more digitally native. There's that much more room for all of us to find our particular audience and community that we're trying to build. So I have so much confidence in the big scale of it. And then nobody knows what Substack is. We talk about it all the time. Nobody knows what Substack is. They might even be subscribed to a Substack and not know what the newsletter service is called. We have so much more room to grow. We're on the edge of the edge of the internet if we're having this conversation. And just every day, more people are learning about these things and getting excited about a new writer that they know the name of, that they reply to, that they have discourse with. And so that really excites me as well. And I don't think in that frame, any of us are competing with each other because there's just so much room for growth. So we're all friendlies. If we can make a great podcast together, tell a great story together, we're all going to win. I'm not worried about somebody stealing from us ever. There's just so much room and so many people that would really love what we're doing and that we haven't even scratched the surface on.
Well said.
What do you think, Kinsey?
I think that the only thing I have to say is like, that's the big picture. That's the reason why if you're thinking about going independent, you should just pull the trigger and do it because it's fun and there's so much space and there's so much opportunity. I also will have to throw in there, I am today 26 years old. And 4 years ago when I was in college, the only opportunities put in front of me were either writing for the internet or writing for a newspaper or writing for a magazine. Two of the three of those are completely obsolete at this point in time. So the ways that media, the like capital M media, have shifted in just the 4 years since I graduated college is absolutely insane. It will continue to compound on all of that, right? The changes will become even more rapid. They will become even more vast. We'll have all sorts of new tools all the time. So completely co-sign everything Josh said. From a more individual creator perspective, my singular piece of advice is that the content has to come first. If you're worried about replicating what somebody else is doing, then you already are. If you can step back and look at things from a bigger perspective and say, I'm doing something that's different because of X, Y, and Z. And if one of them is just, I have a different voice than somebody, I can bring a different perspective to the table, that still counts. As long as you are prioritizing the content itself and that comes first, you will be able to carve out a niche for yourself that is individual, that is unique, that is bringing something new. And that is, of course, currency when we're talking about the modern media space.
That's a good point.
Something I'm curious about to bring in another one of your episodes. Kinsey, you have a lot of beef with Facebook and we're talking about different platforms. So I try to resist asking a double barreled question, but I'll just offer this first one up to have in the back of your mind because I want the answer from you too, Josh. So two part question. So first part that I don't want you to answer now, I'm making this way too complicated, is what is something that podcasting and this process has changed your mind on? Because something that I have had my mind completely changed on, like we'll actually fight people in the streets on, is the idea that Facebook is just not a monopoly. We just had the authors from the New York Times, Shira and Cecilia, to talk about the new Facebook book. And we're just talking about the monopoly accusations. I'm just like, wait a second. Like our entire conversation today is based off of the premise that there's all these different social platforms that we exist on as creators. None of us, I'm going to take a guess. I haven't looked into your stack. None of us are going to use Facebook's new podcasting service. I just know none of us are going to do it. Sagar posts a lot on Instagram, but it's not the only thing he's posting on. The two of you use Twitter Spaces. You don't use Clubhouse. Clubhouse would never get bought by Facebook in a million years because of the FTC's looking into it. So I am just curious, as creators, how do you think of the monopoly debate within tech platforms? Because I think from our perspective, it's not 2015 anymore. It's not 2016 anymore. Snapchat is crushing it. I just really feel strongly about this.
Yeah, it's an unfortunate and sometimes uncomfortable reality that I often have to face as an internet girl. I have the tools that I need to do my job and the tools that I can despise as a person. Like, I hate having to be online and like make a personal brand on the internet. Like, I think it's poisonous. I'll get on a soapbox if you want me to. But at the end of the day, if I don't tweet about my show, if I don't Instagram about the show, no one's going to find out about it. Like, that is the kind of duality of working in media today. I have my personal opinions, but I also recognize that they kind of have to go to the wayside if I want to, I don't know, pay my bills, right? And that's become a little uncomfortable to reckon with. But you make a really interesting point about, you know, is this actually a monopoly? I think the broader question is, how do we define a monopoly in the year of our Lord 2021? Like, there are so many vastly different definitions of what a monopoly or even what anti-competitive behavior really, really is. And I don't think that we have caught up to the point where we can, you know, caught up at least legislatively or even in terms of definitions, have we caught up to the point where these big tech platforms are today? And we say platform, that isn't even what Facebook is, right? Like, Facebook is a collection of a bunch of different platforms that are either previously successful platforms that they bought up or imitations of platforms that have exhibited success and Facebook has then copycatted, right, and made it their own. And I think that is troubling to me. Like, I don't know. Can we define it in technical terms as a monopoly? Maybe not. It's an interesting point that I'm not going to go use Facebook's podcasting platform, but it also is, I think, you know, part of the argument is also that I can't not post on Instagram because I would never find an audience. A small business can't not have a Facebook presence because they would never find consumers to buy their product. And that to me is something that should give us pause. If this is the only pathway to success is to use this other business's tools, I'm not sold. Like, that makes me nervous.
And a quick follow-up to better define my position, because my position isn't that Facebook doesn't do screwed up things. It's not that there aren't literal genocides in like Burma because of Facebook's tools and a lack of responsibility with it. It's more just that when we're talking about antitrust, we are trying to use outdated language, outdated concepts that are actually legal to apply and actually attract problems. And I just want to double click on what you said, Kinsey, which is that, and I don't want to sound pretentious about podcasting here, but what's really cool, what we are able to do is that we curate and like build conversations for people. And something a really good friend of the show, Matt Stoller, has talked about is if you look at the progressive era 100 years ago, something the progressives actually did is they helped come up with language, 40-hour work week, this and that helped people better think of a changing world. And I actually think the thing that motivates me as a podcaster when we're having these conversations is helping people come up with language that better helps define the exact period so that we're not debating 1960s technical stuff. But Josh, please come in.
No, I love what you just said, and I love that you'll fight people in the street about this. I appreciate that. When it comes to Facebook, I'm surprisingly on the same page as what the two of you just said. It monopoly angers me most when you try and say big tech is a monopoly. I'm like, these are all very different companies. Like, these, we need to have different conversations for each of these aspects and then actually understand what we're criticizing. So for me, is it that they buy up social media platforms on the rise? No, I don't think that's what's going on because of what the both of you just mentioned. Am I a little bit concerned about the digital advertising duopoly that Google and Facebook control a crazy amount of digital advertising? Yeah, I'm concerned about it. I am mostly concerned, and this is really what Kinsey's episode was about accountability. And that it becomes a leadership question. Kinsey, you can say it better than I can, is that when we were starting to study this, it wasn't really about Facebook, the company. It was about Zuckerberg, the leader, just refusing to build a company that can actually have a truly positive impact. So if we double click into Facebook, that's my perspective. And if we jump around to Amazon or Apple and talk about different monopolies, we can have different conversations. But that's my perspective.
Well, okay, I'll be the bomb thrower. Why does that matter? Mark's job is to make money. Jeff Bezos' job is to sell stuff in a store. Tim Cook's job is to sell phones. Like, why is it Mark Zuckerberg's job to have he can postulate about making the world a better place, but like, Mark Zuckerberg's job is to addict you to your phone so he can sell more ads. And he's actually very good at it. And he's wildly succeeded. Like, why is it his job to make a positive impact?
But when you run ads to the American people saying you welcome regulation and that you're looking after small businesses, I just don't like it. I'm not saying there's
obviously
playing the game, man.
BS. Yeah, like, you know. But I think the issue for me is like, Sagar, I've interviewed you for my podcast, yeah. right? Like, yeah. I go through a lot of very specific and detailed processes to ensure that I use my very small platform responsibly. I don't want to serve people information that's false. I don't want to give people information that's damaging. I want to be as upfront as possible when I say, this is my opinion. This is what I think. You should go make your own opinion and talk to somebody about this. Like, we take responsibility seriously. And even just being a guest on this show too, like, I can tell that you guys take this craft seriously. You don't want to put out damaging content. How come we can apply that responsibility to our business and Mark Zuckerberg, who has 2 billion plus people using his products every month, can't apply that logic to his business? Like, is my job just to go out and get people to listen to my words, or is my job to get people to listen to my words, but also do it in a responsible way? Like, I perhaps I'm a hopeless optimist, but it is my hope that there is responsibility in capitalism. They are not mutually exclusive. You can be a capitalist, you can be a successful business person, and you can still be held accountable for the actions that you and the people who are under your umbrella perpetrate onto the world. Like, that, those two things don't have to be completely separate to me.
I completely understand what you're saying. I'll put it this way, which is that Marshall and I could be stupendously rich if we wanted to. Like, if we wanted this to be really big, it actually is not that hard, you know? Like, in terms of building up a YouTube audience, we talk a lot about ivermectin and...
the Wuhan like, Lab Lake Hour. The Wuhan Lab Lake Hour. That would be our new like, YouTube channel.
Yeah, like, it's not hard to do, but we just don't want to do that. So we value, you know, we value having a better conversation than money. But here's my counter, which is that it's not our responsibility necessarily. I consider it one of my responsibilities, but I'm talking in terms of like legal meta framework. I think it's the government's job. Like, the government's job is to protect consumers. And if there's a social problem, then we can band together and come and say, hey, Mark, you can't do this. But like, the bounds of behavior shouldn't necessarily, and this is actually kind of what to your previous points, it shouldn't be on Mark Zuckerberg. Like, Zuckerberg's whims should not decide any of this. It should be like social input via Congress. And look, that's a whole other problem whenever you basically just have a bunch of boomers being like, how does my iPhone work? I'm like, oh, cool. Like, you know, we're definitely going to get all this done. So I just feel like what happens is that, to use the tech terminology, we push responsibility like down the stack. Like, it's not Zuckerberg's job. He shouldn't even be concerned about this. His job is to make money. Congress's job and the American people's job and all that is to decide how commerce is conducted between ourselves to represent our social values. Like, that's when I see this conversation, I'm like, I think we're really just coping with the fact that our government sucks and we're not doing anything about this.
Yeah, I like could not agree more. I am 1,000% with you. This should be the job of the government. But we just talked like not 5 minutes ago about how the government has no appropriate mechanism for even understanding the modern economy. Like, they simply don't understand how business gets done today. And that is a huge problem. I think that perhaps my beef with Mark Zuckerberg is a symptom of a larger illness. And that illness is the government has no effing idea how to even govern right now. Like, there is no way to expect them to take any meaningful action. And because of the rapid pace at which technology scales up and scales across the globe, like, the damage is already being done. We've seen it happen time and time again. So I think that my personal reaction is like, gonna grab my pitchfork and like head straight to Menlo Park, right? Like, that is not what it should be. But I think in the absence of a better alternative, that's what it's become.
I think because there's a little too much agreement, I'm going to raise the stakes a little bit and bring up something that's actually going to divide everyone. So recently, the two of you were tweeting about Daniel Ek of Spotify, effectively saying, for the audio listeners, they're nodding so they know where I'm going with this, declaiming responsibility for what Joe Rogan and effectively other podcasters like Alex Cooper of Caller Daddy, Dax Shepard of Armchair Experts say on his platform. And the two of you were very unhappy with this decision. So I will not say your words for you. Josh, let's start with you because you're running the business end of a company. I think you explicitly tweeted this is not how you should run a company or something to that line. And I would do things differently. So before Sagar jumps down your throat, let's hear your vision of how this should actually be approached. You're running a major platform, you're hiring people. What should be done here?
This is a good bridge because it still goes back to moral leadership, which for some reason I have an expectation of, even though I shouldn't. But if you are Spotify and you start off by saying anybody can upload a song, anybody can upload a podcast, and our users can have access to it, that to me is an open platform and you're not directly responsible for the impact of that content. Like that is the law. The Section 230 is saying, hey, you know, we provide the platform. What happens to it is not explicitly our responsibility, if I'm right about that in using shorthand for it. When you start to pay somebody $100 million, if you pay Joe Rogan $100 million and he brings Alex Jones onto the show that you're financing, you have to be responsible for the impact of that dollar. It's no longer just creating an open platform with open opportunity where the algorithm might sort something for a particular person. You're right now making a very specific editorial decision to say, we're getting this person to be only on our platform and we're going to advertise the hell out of them to our user base, more so than the rest of the editorial community that we're bringing on. And so when he gets on an interview and says, it's not my responsibility, he can do whatever he wants, I don't like it. I understand he has to say that, right? If he says something differently, he opens up a much bigger problem that he does not have time, nor does he want to deal with. That's not on his schedule as CEO of Spotify. So I get why he says it, but if you really got him in a one-on-one room and say, you really believe that shit? Come on, like there's just no way. There's something changing. And I want the smartest people in the world who are making the most money in the world to come up with a better solution for it. So that's what I'm looking for, and that's why I don't like it.
How about you, Kinsey?
I agree. I think that it all comes back to accountability and taking the time to apply nuance to some of these headlines, right? I can say, I believe that Daniel Ek, CEO of Spotify, has more responsibility than he is choosing to take right now. That is one sentence, right? But the nuance behind that is, to Josh's point, this was a huge deal. This was a groundbreaking deal in podcasting. We're talking about the most popular podcast in the world. There is more detail here. Like there is, I don't know, tension here that needs to be addressed. And I think to say, like, to apply blanket logic to any of these conversations, even that we've had in this episode, right? It's dangerous. And I think that in the case of Spotify, there are active decisions being made. We all know, like, you know what it means to be on New and Noteworthy on Apple Podcasts. You know what it means to be in that top banner when somebody opens their Spotify app. That can meaningfully change your business and thus your life, right? So Spotify has control over all of these decisions that are being made. They exercise editorial control over what we do for a living. To me, taking a little responsibility for the show that, to Josh's point, you paid out the A for, like, that is, I would say, the bare minimum.
So here's my counter then. And this is what Daniel Ek said. We have rappers who get paid millions of dollars on our platform and we don't control what they say. So by your standard, let's take this most recent, what's his name? DaBaby. I hope, I'm showing like, yeah. DaBaby is being canceled right now for a variety of reasons, mostly which I think are ridiculous, but whatever. So does that mean by the standard that DaBaby should not be being, because I believe Dua Lipa's song with him levitating is one of the top 10 songs in the world as being streamed on Spotify. He's probably clearing a couple hundred grand a month just off of the streaming rights. So yeah. Like by the standard, should DaBaby not be being paid because of his comments elsewhere? It's just like, I think that's ridiculous.
We're not making an argument on Joe Rogan's comments outside of the Spotify exclusive Joe Rogan Experience podcast. Joe Rogan can go do whatever the hell he wants for all I care. But when he is creating Spotify exclusive content that is only available on this platform, I think more responsibility should be exercised. In the case of DaBaby, he made homophobic comments, not in the song Levitating, not in his verse with Dua Lipa, outside in the other rest of the world, right? It was on stage. Of course, you can stop listening to him if you want, but it's not like he went to Spotify directly and said, I want to make a homophobic slur on your show. I want to spread disinformation about the AIDS pandemic or AIDS epidemic on your show on Spotify. That would be a different case. Like, DaBaby's not doing that.
I'm switching teams here, and I agree with Josh in that my beef with Daniel Ek is I don't think, like you said, Josh, I don't think he actually believes what he's literally saying here in a way that is setting up all sorts of trouble down the line. So, for example, how much trouble does Jack Dorsey get in for 7 years ago saying, I believe that Twitter is the free speech company, we're the free speech wing of the free speech party? He didn't literally believe that. He was saying it hypothetically. He didn't actually mean that. I do not believe that Spotify's actual position is Joe Rogan to could say literally whatever he like if Joe Rogan were to start saying, let's say vaccine denial hour, and he's not doing this, but let's say he dedicated the next 3 months to just denying the vaccine. Not just denying it, right? But actually promoting disinformation, like incontrovertible disinformation. Obviously Spotify would do something about it. So it's just very disingenuous from my perspective to put out that position when you're going to have to walk it back someday. And I don't think Joe Rogan's going to pull that. He's in his 50s. He's been doing this for 20 years. I think he knows what he's doing. But I just see a world in the 2030s or something, if we're even still listening to podcasts under this format, where this really, frankly, not actually true standard is going to be used to have a really incoherent conversation. And there are so many people, I don't know about your listeners, but there are so many of our listeners who've had their, and I'm sorry guys, but who've had their minds warped by really weak language and thinking around how these things actually work. When people actually say, well, Facebook's, you know, the public term, like that is not how anyone at Facebook conceives of what Facebook is. So you should actually understand how Mark Zuckerberg conceives of it. But yeah, please cut it, come in.
Well, we have comps today. We don't need to wait that long. YouTube AdSense is for everybody. If you generate a certain amount of traffic on YouTube, you get money. And it's based on a certain equation about how valuable the audience, how long they watch it, and they turn off monetization for certain people and for certain categories. And so YouTube's been around a little bit longer. They've made a bunch of different mistakes and they've learned through it. So they've adapted their rules in a certain way. And I don't know what the legality that they're following or if any of it actually lines up one-to-one, but if you're Spotify and whether it's DaBaby getting streaming revenue or whether you're getting a direct deal, there just has to be more thought put into it. We already have examples from across the internet. I don't want to wait 20, 30 years to have to listen to this again and say, damn, I wish Daniel Ek did something differently.
Here's why I think it probably won't go this way, which is that Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube are places where everyone can come in, and thus they have to have those policies. Spotify gets to choose who goes Spotify exclusive. So Spotify, Joe Rogan. Spotify, Alex Cooper. I can guarantee you Alex Jones is not going Spotify exclusive anytime soon. I can guarantee you Steven Crowder is not getting a Spotify deal anytime soon. So I just don't think this is going to be an issue. And I think a lot of it really is just, look, Joe is a friend of mine, so, you know, take that for what it is. But like, I think a lot of people just hate Joe. And like, people, you know, get pissed off that he has a really large audience and then they want to turn it into this whole meta conversation. Everything he's basically said, in my opinion, is within a completely acceptable rounds of debate. Even when the Alex Jones episode, and look, I think Alex Jones is a sack of shit, and I know I'll get a lot of pushback from that from people who like me, but I don't really care. Sandy Hook is actually unforgivable. That being said, if you go and you look at the episode where Rogan had him on, to your point, Kinsey, every single thing he said was fact-checked live while it was happening. A lot of people who criticized his episode didn't actually watch it. And so what they're doing is they're bringing in the outside standard of Sandy Hook, he said this thing in 2013. And look, from my perspective, I have no interest in talking with Alex. I would never have him on any of my platforms specifically for this reason. But that's, you know, Joe can make a different decision if he wants to. So I just look at it as, I understand where you guys are coming from. It just seems like once you open the door, and this is why I respect Daniel, is he's saying not only to his own employees who are trying to pressure him, but he's also saying to, you know, the New York Times, to a lot of these other people, no, like, you're not going to have a impact on our editorial decision. And from a business perspective, Joe Rogan's the best thing ever happened to Spotify. In a lot of ways, he got ripped off. He added billions to their market cap. He's probably added, I mean, tens of that millions of people, including myself, actually, who switched to Spotify for podcasts specifically because he was on there. The only reason I ever used Apple is because I couldn't get him on Spotify. So I just threw a lot at both of you. Whoever wants to take it can take it.
Yeah, Kinsey, you got something to say too.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, the more troubling aspect of this conversation is not, to your earlier point, Marshall, that, you know, Joe Rogan is going to do like the anti-vaccine power hour, right? It's when Joe Rogan toes the line between truth and the opposite of truth, or the absence of truth, right? It's when anybody toes the line between what is truthful and what is not truthful. That is what should be concerning, because that's a lot harder to pick out. That's a lot harder to identify. It's a lot harder to say, well, this was just wrong, because it's murky. And we as consumers of media, of products, of whatever, insert whatever here, we have to exercise a little bit more judgment there, because we so often, I know everyone listening to this, all of us here have done it before, you see something online and you're like, I'm going to use that in a conversation later, right? You don't click the headline. You don't keep reading. You don't fact check whether it's true. We allow small tidbits of information to govern our logic a lot of the time. And that is really, really dangerous, because it's really hard for these platforms. Even if Daniel Ek did accept responsibility, it would be really hard for him to identify that murky point between truth and the absence of truth. And that is what we should be afraid of. Kind of like the billionaires, you know, like it's not Elon Musk we should be worried about. It's like the Ken Griffins of the world we should be worried about.
Right. And look, we're never going to completely agree on this, but I think once again, like, this is just another illustration of how language and like mental frameworks, I think that's the funniest thing about my interest in politics and policy of late has been that I've been less interested in this specific policy or that specific thing. I'm more interested, hey, how do we ask the right questions? How do we actually think about things the right way? Because I think that's where the biggest gap exists. Josh, do you have something to say?
There's a big difference between not liking somebody and thinking they should be canceled or deplatformed. I cannot like Joe Rogan and say he should have a show, he should make money, he should do whatever he wants. He's just not for me. And I think that we lose a lot of that nuance when you start throwing middle fingers and only reading the headline again. Yeah. And so it's totally like, I don't think less of Sagar because he likes Joe Rogan. I just have a different perspective, and that's fine. We're not going to agree on everything. That's it.
So for the last question, which I'm super curious what you all think about this. Sagar, you made a bunch of YouTube AdSense dollars over segments dunking on CNN for announcing CNN Plus, CNN effectively for millennials and the Gen Z crowd that is not subscribing to cable. I want us to all, this would be easiest for Josh, don't imagine ourselves as semi-cynical podcasters, but imagine that we're some poor suit dude or woman in an office in New York City, works at Warner. Your job is to figure out how exactly you get people to pay for news outside of the cable bundle to actually build up on this legacy system that is slowly still profitable, as Josh pointed out, but also falling apart slowly but surely. Josh, what do you do to actually make something like this work from a business perspective?
You get creative and name it anything other than CNN Plus. How many times are we going to get a Plus service? I'm so frustrated by corporate America for not having more ways of calling a premium service. I don't think it's a bad move, right? Go digital. What's wrong with that? Is it a big deal? Like, they're part of a bigger conglomerate that has probably similar technology at this point to create an app on Roku and phones and have the subscription. I think as long as they keep creating what they call value, I don't, CNN for me is whatever, but as long as any media entity continues to create valuable content, they should be able to move with these waves and to move with the trends. And one of these big things is saying, let's have our own gated ecosystem that people pay to participate in. We can sell our own ads, we can build an ad server, whatever. I think it's great. I don't know if it's that big of a deal. I think it's just more of the same.
Kinsey, go ahead.
Can you smell my skepticism? Yeah. I think that like there are two ways to approach this, right? I think the first way is potentially less important, but like to consider the behavior of everyday news consumers, people who are going to CNN. I'm not like going to CNN.com to look at my news, right? Like the only time I, as someone in my mid-20s, who admittedly is like a newsy person, the only time I watch CNN is when I'm at the doctor's office or like in a waiting room. Like nobody's going to CNN anymore. It's maybe your parents and like even them, like my parents hate CNN. Most people's probably do. Yeah. Like that is not the behavior. And I think that it illustrates perhaps a lack of understanding of what the core consumer wants. Like it reeks of we're doing it because everybody else is doing it. As my mother always says, if everybody else jumped off the Brooklyn Bridge, would you? And like in the case of CNN, potentially the answer should be no. Find a different way to diversify your revenue. Find a different way to stay modern. Don't focus focus on just replicating what you did for however many years, what, 20, 30, 40 years at this point on cable news in digital. Create a different product. Create something that's more specific, geared toward the digital world, not this cable world. I think that that is the biggest failing of CNN Plus, or you know, potentially, right? Like, I could be completely wrong. We don't know yet.
All right. So last actual question, guys. You finished your first season. You did 10 episodes. What's the plan for season two of Thinking is Cool?
The plan for season two of Thinking is Cool is to go all out. Season one was all about getting our sea legs, understanding what we were good at, what our strengths were. And now that we understand those, season two is going to be just an absolute banger after banger of episodes. We're going to focus a lot on issues that we have heard about from our community. A lot of the first season was about trying to figure out what we thought people thought was most compelling. Season two is all about, now that we know what people care about, we're going to talk about exactly those things. So more big issues, big questions, diverse perspectives, different voices you've never heard before, talking about issues that you should absolutely bring to your group chat, to your dinner table, to wherever you go next. I'm very excited. It's going to be awesome. And everybody should go check it out.
Love it. Where can people find the show?
We are available on any podcasting platform of your choice, including Spotify. It's just called Thinking is Cool. You can search us. If you want to find us on social, we're all over Instagram, Twitter, etc. And if you want to send me any ideas or any feedback or anything, I would love to hear from people. My email is Kinsey, K-I-N-S-E-Y, at thinkingiscool.com.
Awesome. We'll have links down in the description. Really appreciate it, guys. It was a lot of fun. I enjoyed it.
Thank you so much for having us. This was awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hope you guys enjoyed the episode. Reminder, Substack subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and most importantly, realignment conference signups. Not everyone who applies is going to be able to make it, but we'll definitely put stuff together in the future because we're getting so many awesome people who are reaching out. And of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.